This is Junk Food Cinema.
Lying on your bed, staring up at the moon. You got me crazy, gotta love you soon. I'm your backdoor lover, coming from behind. Oh yeah, backdoor lover, just you and me, you know it has to.
Welcome, pussycats and backdoor lovers, to the cult film podcast du jour, Junk Food Cinema, brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.com.
.com.
It's a good time for the great taste of McDonald's.
.mcdonalds. .aol. .target. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and joining me, as per usual, is my friend and co-host.
Brought to you by the film Marvel's Doctor Strange.
The Shaggy to My Fred, C. Robert Cargill.
Welcome to Riverdale, bitches!
Which is what the Netflix show was going to be called. Welcome to Riverdale, comma, bitches. This is still Gals Who Rock. And we are still rocking on. And if you want to know what we did last week, well, I mean, it was, ladies and gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains. But before that, there are all these other episodes you can listen to on iTunes and on Blog Talk Radio Network. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. Like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema. And we didn't even mention this last week, but if you really like the show, if you find that that Junk Food Cinema is the new radio, I don't know. If Junk Food Cinema is the new Junk Food Cinema, you can actually pledge on patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. For as little as $1 an episode, you will get access to bonus content that only you guys get to hear. At the $5 an episode level and above, you'll get even more bonus content that nobody else gets to hear. So it's a really good way to help support the show, because you know who we're not getting money from are any of the 72 companies that have product placement in this week's film.
And we'll talk about that.
Yes,
because
we will.
That is a major part of this film. I'm really excited about this. One of the interesting things about this month we also didn't mention last week is you haven't seen any of these
Zero.
Movies. These are all movies I've been trying to get on us to cover for a couple of years now, and then just realized, hey, there's a bunch of movies all about girls in rock bands that are fucking awesome. And why don't we fucking do a month of that? So this was another movie you had never seen.
Yeah, I had been kind of actively avoiding.
You busted the balls of this fucking movie on our Can't Hardly Wait podcast, at which point I called you out on it, and you were like, oh shit, maybe I should check that out. And then a bunch of our listeners called you out on that, and we've been meaning to do this episode, and here we are. And how do you feel about this movie, Brian?
I feel like I slipped in the back door of this movie. I didn't know ahead of time. I didn't know when it was first released. I didn't get it. But after slipping through that back door, I mean, it is a love.
Are you now a backdoor lover?
I'm a backdoor lover of
this
film. Are
you coming from behind with the lights down low?
It's a love that's more than hot that I have for Josie and the Pussycats.
They were three small-town girls with big-time dreams.
Who's a rock star?
I am.
Who wanted to share their music with the world.
We can't sit around here waiting for it to happen. We are musicians. We should be out there playing music.
We do play.
Nobody believed in them.
You know, you suck.
But they believed in themselves.
We're special.
Yeah, special Ed.
Now, fate is giving the Pussycats the chance of a lifetime.
We'd love for you to sign with Mega Records.
How am I gonna pull this off? I'm a girl from Riverdale. I'm not a rock star.
You gotta believe in yourself.
Things are finally going their way. But between the mania...
Is that Joseph?
They're gonna be huge!
The managers.
We decide everything.
What's hot and what's not.
Welcome to your party.
Who else thinks that Fiona's a freak?
And the media.
We're gonna be on TRL?
Mm-hmm. Yeah!
This may be the toughest gig they've ever played.
No matter what happens, we will always be friends first.
Josie and the Pussycats.
This movie is such a great satire of its era. And it's such a great pairing with last week's movie.
It is. Like, that was the craziest part to me, is falling head over heels in love with Ladies and Gentlemen, the Fabulous Staines. And then even as I agreed to do Josie and the Pussycats, even as you had gotten up on all of the soapboxes that you keep in your garage and gone to bat for this movie, I was still a little trepidatious. And then as I'm watching it, I realized they're covering the exact same topic in two different ways. One is extremely cynical, and one is cynical with its tongue firmly in its cheek, and that is Josie and the Pussycats.
Yeah.
And that theme that it's covering is the absurdity of fads, and I feel like the more I keep yelling about the absurdity of fads, it should end with me killing you with an axe. Like, I really got to stop stealing from Patrick Bateman. But that's what it's about. It's about how fickle trends are, and then when everything turns over, you just forget about yesterday's news.
And how it's just all about selling the trends.
Yes.
That it's not actually about selling content. It's not actually about selling stuff. It's just about selling.
Yeah,
patreon.com/junkfoodcinema.
Now, the pedigree of this movie that we need to discuss is this is written and directed by the writers and directors of Can't Hardly Wait, which, of course, is a deep-fried favorite of ours.
Now, that is the first of many connections to last week's film, is that the writer-director team behind this movie, Harry Elfrunt and Deborah Kaplan, are also two-and-done filmmakers, much like
Lou Adler.
Lou Adler made two movies, directed two movies, and that was it. Elfrunt and Kaplan directed two movies, and that was it.
And two great movies!
Great movies!
Like, that's the thing, is that I don't, like, they were just, they were in the right place at the wrong time. Like, and you know, I hate to be Dr. John about it, but their movies have stuck around, and their movies have really connected and are the types of movies that everyone looks back on them fondly. But at the time they came out, they did not make the impact because, let's face it, this era that they were making movies was a super saccharine era where we were taking shine and veneer as substance. Like, the late 90s. Okay, so let's here's a little weird thing about how music works. In what happens is music is constantly chasing the new. It's constantly chasing fads. And what you have is someone will come along and change the face of music, and as a result, everyone else will follow. And you end up with these periods where music is really good, and then something will happen. Like, let's start with the early 70s, which is a period much like the mid 90s, in which nobody, like, acid rock is just come and gone, psychedelic soul has come and gone, and nobody knows what the new thing is, and so they're grasping at straws. So you get this very eclectic period of music, and then finally disco shows up, and holy shit, disco, and we're all about disco until the moment disco dies. And then what do? Well, we have this.
We release Saturday Night Fever.
When
disco dies.
Well, disco dies, and then 3 months later, Skate Town USA comes out.
I love that I went for the actual, like, signpost of culture in disco, and you went for Skate Town USA.
I went for the, if you pass the gas station, you've gone too far. So then you have, like, new wave music and punk, like, really exploded in that scene. And then, you know, you get to the late 80s and all this stuff has died off and music becomes really shitty as the music industry is trying to figure itself out. And then grunge happens, and grunge is huge. And then grunge dies in 95. And the music starts grasping at straws again. And you get this really eclectic, you know, series of music. Like, if you remember from the mid-90s, we've got pop punk starts rising. We get groups like Squirrel Nut Zippers and Space starts popping up. You have ska becomes big for 3 seconds. Big Band comes back for a brief spell.
I just realized this is the era when they released that music compilation series, Now That's What I Call Music. And because of the era it was released, should have been called We're Not Really Sure What to Call Music.
Right. And then what happened in 1998 is music started sucking shit through a straw. And if you disagree with me, I'm going to mention that I'm talking about boy bands, Britney Spears, pop punk, and Creed. This is what happened. Dude, look up 1998. All of a sudden, the music goes from, we go from having Prodigy and Squirrel Nut Zippers and Letters to Cleo, who's going to come up in a minute, and all this crazy eclectic rock and punk and dance music where the music industry is throwing shit at the wall. And all of a sudden, what sticks? Vitamin C, Creed, 98 Degrees. You know, where the best of them is the stuff that we look back ironically and really enjoy, like Backstreet Boys and Jessica Simpson. No, we don't.
NSYNC, motherfucker.
NSYNC. Like, that's where we, you know, the bigger bands we look back on and it's like, you know, Backstreet's back. All right. You know what? There is a certain song by the Backstreet Boys that when one of us puts on at karaoke, you, me, and two other guys go up and fucking belt the shit out of it because we have no shame, and God damn it, it's a good song.
Well, I'll get drunk and do a Nick Cannon impression on a karaoke mic any day of the fucking week.
But not
Nick Cannon, but Nick
that's
Carter.
But that's the best of this era. Like, yeah. This era was bad, and this movie is about making fun of something that was really bad.
Now I imagine Creed like recording a song like, can we set the bar lower? Oh God, I hated Creed.
Open.
Oh God, I fucking hate Creed.
Get all the pews in church.
And well, I'm gonna sell to Christians and not make money. It's like, you fucking suck. You were the worst thing until Nickelback shows up. You know what? Creed is the old Nickelback.
They are. Nickelback is just a Creed knockoff band. In fact, for a while, I thought they were a Creed cover band because I couldn't tell the fucking difference. It's like, oh, you're Creed without the Jesus. I get it.
I put money in this jukebox thinking it was Creed, and now I want my nickel back. That's what we're going to call ourselves. Boom, done, over.
But so this movie was making fun of something that was really big at the time and nobody really realized was awful except the, you know, it seemed really up on its high horse and wagging its finger.
Yeah.
And really, it wasn't because, dear God, that period fucking sucked.
Yeah.
But so the movie opens.
What you're saying is that Josie and the Pussycats is more about taking down the music and the pop culture trends of the time than it is about Josie and the Pussycats.
It really is. Like, in fact, Josie and the Pussy, like, they do a lot of great meta stuff.
They do.
And they do a lot with the comic because they get the comic straight. And they nail the comic, which is great. Although, I want to do a quick sidebar. This was something
I found. Let me get the beer.
A weird thing that I realized in watching this movie, I grew up with Josie and the Pussycats. Like, I grew up with the
weirdly, so did I.
I grew up with the cartoon show. It was, you know, it was played, you know, ad nauseum in my youth. This movie, of course, came, you know, when I was really young. You know, I was in my early 20s. Like, Josie and the Pussycats has been an ever-present part of my life. And there's a new show on right now that's just two seasons in called Riverdale, which is really fantastic trash TV. It's like so much fun. It's like if the best way I've found to describe it, it's like if Twin Peaks were made for the CW, that's Riverdale. And it has Josie and the Pussycats are characters in Riverdale. But they did something really interesting in Riverdale in which Josie and the Pussycats is an all-black band. Huh. And so now that I've watched a season of that as Josie and the Pussycats, in my head, that's the definitive Josie and the Pussycats. So going back to watch a Josie and the Pussycats that's true to the comic, which is one black girl and two white girls, seemed really weird because I was like, what are two white girls doing in an all-black band? And it's really, it's kind of the power of representation in where we are in this era. It made me think of like the only other instance like that is now that Sam Jackson has played Nick Fury. Like, I grew up reading Marvel Comics. To me, Nick Fury is this white, you know, this white guy from the 40s. Not anymore. Like, if they ever cast a white guy or draw Nick Fury as a white guy ever again, I'm going to be like, that's not Nick Fury. Like, that's the David Hasselhoff bad knockoff Nick Fury. No, Nick Fury's black.
I need to track down and watch that movie. I've never actually seen it.
Oh, no, you don't.
Oh, I need to know.
You don't, by the way, you do not need to see David Hasselhoff's Nick Fury.
I need to know.
And by do not, I mean you absolutely have to see.
Tell me, baby girl, because I need to know. Speaking of music that was terrible at the time.
Yes. But that's the experience I had watching this. Like, once you've watched Riverdale, the idea of a white Josie just seems wrong. Because I feel like the best representation ever is this new version of Riverdale. When you believe in magic, but let's go to this Riverdale.
I feel like we need to talk a little bit about what this movie is actually doing, because I know, by the way, audience, move down to the front. There's plenty of seats available from all the folks that left when we said we were covering Josie and the Pussycats. And I get it.
Seriously, I think you're the only one.
I'm not the only one who didn't give... I'm sorry. Are you saying I'm the only person that didn't give Josie and the Pussycats a shot when it came out? Because I think
I'm saying that over the last, almost two decades, enough people have seen it that it's kind of beloved.
Anyway, so what this is based on... and
I'm saying you're late to the fucking party,
yeah,
pal.
Fine, whatever. The point is... be a fucking professional. The point is... I also grew up with Josie and the Pussycats because I grew up in the era that Cartoon Network was just starting to become a thing. And when they first launched, they were classic cartoons only. They weren't making the first stuff they made was the Powerpuff Girls and Dexter's Laboratory. Before that, all they were showing was
they
reruns.
They were just a repertory
thing. They were basically Hanna-Barbera's satellite channel, because that's all that they showed. And so I grew up with the quartet. And the quartet is Scooby-Doo.
Yep.
Josie and the Pussycats, yep. Jabberjaw, mm-hmm. and Speed Buggy. What I mean by quartet is it's the same fucking show four times.
Yes.
It is the blood sport of mystery solving bands. Like,
yes.
That's every show was exactly the same. And Josie and the Pussycats was so much like Scooby-Doo. They literally had a broad-chested blonde guy with an ascot and the voice of Casey Kasem. Like, yes. They were not being shy about what they were ripping off. But that's not where Josie and the Pussycats started, as Cargill alluded to. It started in 1962 in Archie Comics. It was characters that were introduced within Archie Comics that then in the late 60s spun off into their own thing and went through all these different tweaks. And then in 1970, Hanna-Barbera put out, for less than a year, this show ran. It was not super popular.
No.
And then you jump ahead to the early 2000s, where we have... the writers, directors of Can't Hardly Wait, finding an opportunity to say, yes, this is an absurd thing to adapt in this day and age. And yes, it's a thing that we're marketing this to an audience that's probably never even heard of this show. This is, of course, prior to Riverdale experiencing a resurgence on Netflix by a decade or so.
And then it delightfully has a moment where they wink at the audience that is following along and playing along with the home game, where the obnoxious sister of their manager is on the plane and someone says, I don't even know why you're still here.
She says, I'm here because I was in the comic.
And he goes,
what? Nothing.
And that's everything you need to know about the movie from then on. Once that moment happens, it's like, oh, this is a tongue-in-cheek meta comic book movie. Okay, I'm on board.
It is very clever. It is smarter than it has any right to be. And it's...
phrase I have a strong aversion to.
Cool. Probably worth diverting the show to talk about. But it's that thing where it is very self-aware of that absurdity and plays with it in a way that feels like prototype Lord and Miller movies. Like, it's something that we would see when Lord and Miller did 21 Jump Street.
Yes, exactly. It is that type of... it is a movie that's like, look, we're doing this nostalgia thing. You're here because you know exactly what this is. That's why you're watching it. It's the whole reason you're here. So let's acknowledge it and then go make a fun comedy about it.
Yeah. And so now that you know that, this movie opens with a performance not by Josie and the Pussycats, but by the boy band...
Du Jour.
Du Jour, which, by the way... I now realize that we have been doing a patron exclusive segment for a long time called Junk Food a la Mode that should have been called Junk Food Du Jour. Absolutely fucking should have been called Junk Food Du Jour, because as you know,
it's of the day.
Du Jour means with cheese. So that's something that we absolutely should have glommed on to Junk Food Cinema. It would make so much sense. But so Du Jour is a quartet boy band played in the movie by Donald Faison, Seth Green, Breckin Meyer,
who, by the way, was in a relationship with one of the directors at the time, which is why he was in both this along with Donald Faison and Seth Green. in Can't Hardly Wait.
Which is funny because this whole segment, these characters feel like the, hey, do you remember Can't Hardly Wait? Because they're, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but they're the only group of people in this movie who are also in Can't Hardly Wait, but they're right there at the beginning.
I'm pretty certain they're the only carryovers because I know none of the main members of Josie and the Pussycats were in it, and none of the other main characters. There might be like side appearances by people, but no, there are no other main characters from Can't Hardly Wait. Also amusing is DuJour shows up, and DuJour is in the beginning of this movie so much so that you almost feel like it's DuJour's movie because it takes a while to get to Josie and the Pussycats. Once they're gone, they never reappear. Even though they do. and we'll get there because that's actually one of my favorite jokes in the movie.
They never reappear.
Because
even though
the only person who reappears in this is the guy you didn't name because no one knows who the Bucky is.
Yeah.
Because he was the one guy that they could get to come back for that scene.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Which is hilarious. But yeah, so this is, like I said, adapting a cartoon that was ripping itself off so much that it was like Scooby-Doo was the old Josie and the Pussycats. It just kind of kept self-replicating. But they open with a song that
is one of the greatest songs in music history.
How do I put this accurately? It is never for the rest of my life going to leave my head. It is in there now, and it's locked in like a parasite.
And the obnoxious thing about it is you can find it on YouTube. Dozens of copies of it on YouTube. I have not found a version higher than 360p. Like, it is... like, I think it was on the DVD, and people ripped it from the DVD back in 2006 and have been posting it to YouTube. And there is... essentially, they made a whole music video of it. It's a single-shot music video. I swear to God, they had to have gotten Joseph Kahn to direct it. Like, it looks like a Joseph Kahn video. Like, that's like, and that's the beauty. They're at the very least making fun of Joseph Kahn before any of you knew who Joseph Kahn was. But it is the DuJour music video of the song Backdoor Lover.
Let me read you some lyrics.
Read some lyrics of Backdoor Lover rather than sing them, because I will sing them.
Now, if you listen very carefully, you may pick up a hidden second meaning. This kind of love is wrong, but you know it feels so right. Running my hands across your cheeks, they're oh so smooth and white. So leave the light on, baby, and unlock your back door. I'll be coming through that way tonight to love you for sure. Lying on your bed, staring up at the moon, you got me crazy, but I'll love you soon. I'm your backdoor lover.
Coming from behind with the lights down low.
Backdoor lover, just you and me.
No one has to know.
No one has to know. Let me meet you there at your secret spot. I'll show you a love that's more than hot. Segwaying off of this.
What are they trying? Like, what is the deeper meaning here?
The deep, getting in their deep meaning.
I feel like we have to plunge into a dark hole to scoop out the meaning.
Yeah, the balls deep meaning of this particular song, which leads me into another edition of Unfiltered Wife.
Here it is.
Hey-o. So I'm sitting there and I'm watching this, and she just got home from work, and I'm watching this movie, and I will be honest, for the second time, and this opening is playing, and I'm changing my son, and she's in the other room, and all of a sudden I just hear her go, "Wait, what? What are they singing about?" And I just turned and I was like, "I'll give you three guesses, and the first two you don't even need." And she says, "That's not subtle." And I said to her, if there was one thing the early 2000s was not known for, it was subtlety. I mean, you look at the giant goggles and the space suits that people were fucking wearing. This was not an era of time where we were like, you know what? Let's tone it down.
Yeah.
So it makes perfect sense that this is the song that they use to lampoon boy bands. And of course,
DuJour is the perfect epitome of that boy band model, and they're making fun of it right down to, you've got, you know, the three good looking guys and the ugly one. So they're just hammering home, just like, this is what this is, and we're mocking this. And they go after it relentlessly and get a lot of really great jokes out of it. DuJour is incredibly funny. I mean, of course, you have three really super talented comedians.
And fourth guy.
and a fourth guy.
I feel so bad. I feel like the guy's like, come on, man. I was in the movie too.
He Googles Josie and the Pussycat constantly and found this, and he's listening to this podcast. He's like, guys, come on.
We're not even going to come up on his Google.
I have a name. It's on IMDb. It's right in front of you, and you're not mentioning it.
And because we're not using his name, it's not going to come up on his Google alert, and I'm very sorry about that. But I like how much they dig into not just the, again, this is about the fleeting nature of the music industry, which is why they're called du jour, which, of course, in French means heart disease. So,
It means with sauce.
With sauce, yes, avec du jour. So, yeah, and then on top of that, they're wearing ridiculous clothing. They're arguing about who's going to claim what poses. They're arguing about, oh,
my face.
My face.
He stole my face.
Oh, that's right. He stole my face. Yeah, and there's a lot of bickering and infighting. And into the movie rides Alan Cumming.
Alan fucking Cumming.
Which is the first of many points where I'm like, this is also kind of a spiritual sequel to Spice World.
Oh, no, it really is, because Alan Cumming is, this movie has a lot of the same satire that Spice World had, yes. And it's got Alan Cumming bridging the gap, and Alan Cumming is the only person in this movie that breaks the fourth wall.
Yes.
And has a great fourth wall breaking moment where it's like, oh, yes, this is the spirit of what this is.
Well, both movies are commentaries on the music industry, the absurdity of fads. It's just that one is a fake movie with a real band, and one's a real movie with a fake band.
Exactly.
And, okay, can we sidebar for just a second? The more I see
the
of him...
The sidebar.
This is where we drink.
Star Grove.
This is where we drink. I want to do an entire month of Alan Cumming at some point, and I don't know, maybe in April, and just call it The Cumming Spring. Like, we need to talk more. Like, this guy, no matter what you give him to do, is always so fucking funny. I think he's even funnier in this movie than he was in Spice World, because he is like, he's given a character who's kind of the opposite of the one he plays from Spice World, who has the clout and has, because of that, developed such an ego and is such a snoot. And he's got that, like,
I don't understand why he's still not constantly do, like, he was doing stuff for 10 years straight. That was, and he was amazing. He was one of my first interviews, actually.
Really?
Yeah. Film.com showed up and they're like, hey, we'd like you to do video interviews. And I got to, he was my first interview, and I got
to. Was it for X-Men 2?
No, it was after that. In fact, one of the things I asked him at the end was if he was going to be Nightcrawler again. And he actually gave me this definitive answer. That was like the centerpiece of the thing, which was, it was the first time he was like really on record talking about why he didn't want to do X-Men again and why he wasn't going to play Nightcrawler. He hated the makeup chair.
Yeah.
Like it's literally that he's like 8 hours a day in makeup to then go and shoot a full day of making movies. He's like, that's not how you make movies. It's not, I just can't do it. And it's like, okay, that's fair. That's really fair. Like, I mean, you get people like when you talk about Hellboy, you know, how they did Hellboy, he would sleep in the chair while they did him up. Like that was most of where he got his sleep, was in the makeup chair, so that he could then wake up and go and make the movie. Like it's really hard on people. And some people are really into it and really dig it, and some people do not, and he just did not. But yeah, we talked about that. But yeah, so now we're done with the side. Star Grove.
Du jour. So Alan Cumming is their manager, and as they're fighting, one of the things that they're fighting about is that they're hearing this weird sound in the background of their new track, and as he listens, he goes, no, I have no idea what that is, and then immediately goes up to the pilot, who is played, by the way, by Harry Elfrunt, one of the writer's directors, and says, take the Chevy to the levee, which is such a clever code for crash this plane.
Yes.
Like, that is like three levels of music nerdy I'm not even prepared to go into.
How did this pair not stick around making movies? Like, their movies are so fucking sharp. They're so fucking smart. They're so fucking funny. And lines like that, this movie's peppered with them. There's so much great subtle stuff going on here. But yeah, take the Chevy to the levee, where they then grab their parachutes and jump out of the plane and the plane crashes.
Yeah, and again, Elfrunt and Kaplan are the old Lord Miller, and I feel like that's the thing they were doing first, is we're going to make a movie either in a genre or adapting a thing that you don't have a lot of expectation for, but we're going to do something really sharp and really smart with it, and I would love to have seen what else they could do moving forward into the 2000s. But so now that they've had to ditch du jour, the company Mega Records that Alan Cumming works for needs a new band to be the next thing.
And needs it in 24 hours.
And wouldn't you know it, they happen to ditch the plane and crash down in Riverdale, where there is a struggling girl group called Josie and the Pussycats playing a gig at everyone's favorite music location, a bowling alley.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. You're a great crowd.
Okay, girls, we need the lane now. And your shoes.
That does not go terribly well for them, and they are just trying to make it. They are about to play a gig outside of a store when the manager of the store chases them off by calling the cops, and that's where Alan Cumming literally almost runs into them with the car and decides they are the next big thing. And the Pussycats are played by Rachel Lee Cook as Josie. We have Tara...
Who is never more adorable in any movie than she is in this movie.
You are so fucking
like,
right.
This is peak Rachel Lee Cook.
She is absolutely beautiful in this movie, and so you just want to hug her. And then you have playing the role of Melody, who is the ditzy drummer, is Tara Reid. And then playing the part of Valerie, who was in the original cartoon, the original comic strip, the only ethnic member of the band, and now all of them are, according to Netflix. This is played by Rosario Dawson,
who, oddly enough, one of the weird ironies of this movie is Rosario Dawson is playing the character who everyone forgets and is never around and is like invisible. And she's the one person from this movie who went on to a stellar fucking career.
And yes, and they make note of that several times in this movie where she, like, they'll start taking off in the limo and he'll be like, oh, I'm sorry, I had no idea you weren't in here. Like, they make several references to her, like, being,
motherfucker, you are leaving the biggest star of this fucking movie behind in every fucking scene.
You are leaving Rosario Dawson on the sidewalk, and no one leaves Rosario Dawson on the sidewalk. There's your fucking t-shirt. Also, another weird Spice World tie-in, that there's a moment where he's handing out invitations for a party and she doesn't get one, and I kept waiting for him to be like, oh, that's okay, because
tonight is the night when three become one.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, why can't that moment be? Plus, when he discovers them, who's playing on the fucking radio? Meatloaf! Meatloaf is playing on the fucking radio when he discovers them. That can't be accidental.
It can't be.
Come on, guys.
There's so much Meatloaf in this podcast right now.
There is.
We've done a lot of Meatloaf over the last few months.
There is so much Meatloaf in this podcast right now. Yeah, we're about to launch our first actual shirt, the Stargroove t-shirt. And now every time I hear you say things like that, I'm like, that's a fucking t-shirt. There's so much Meatloaf in this podcast right now. Would be a very odd t-shirt. So Josie and the Pussycats, in a sort of whirlwind type of scenario, are rushed into the limelight, and they are the new big thing. And even though they haven't played a single show, everyone's in love with them, and they're getting makeovers, and they're on all of these products. And that's when we learn that Mega Records isn't just making records. They're actually part of a huge conspiracy. They are
huge, actual conspiracy, like tied in with world governments.
Yes, where they actually send subliminal messages through music to get kids to buy literally anything that they want. They are the people who establish the trends. They are the cell Illuminati, where it's like, no matter what it is, we are going to get kids to buy it by putting subliminal messages in music.
Patreon.com/junkfoodcinema.
And they're really jerking at it.
They're jerking great. And it turns out it doesn't matter who the band is or what kind of music they play, as long as they can get this subliminal message out. And that's really why they need the Pussycats.
That said, let's talk about the music for a second.
Let's do talk about the music.
Because the music in this movie is fucking great.
It's really good, which is not surprising considering the soundtrack of Can't Hardly Wait is also really good.
Well, yes, but the thing is the lead singer of Josie and the Pussycats, not actually Rachel Lee Cook, but the lead singer of Letters to Cleo, who, by the way, many of you will remember as the band playing on top of the school at the end of 10 Things I Hate About You, a band that I saw live a couple of times back in the 90s. Me and my wife were big Letters to Cleo fans, and we went and saw, in fact, the first concert I took my wife to on one of our early dates was a Letters to Cleo concert.
Nice.
And she's amazing. Kay, I'm blanking on her last name, but she does the voice of Josie and the Pussycats. And this music is so happy and poppy and just enjoyable. And it was one of those things watching this movie and really kind of like getting into it and being reminded, because the Grammys were just this week, the week we're recording. And one of the big things that a lot of people complain about is they don't even bother to show the rock awards anymore. Like, rock bands are like, yeah, whatever. It had the lowest, they took a nosedive and had the lowest ratings they've ever had for the Grammys. And someone, you know, definitely pointed out that, well, you've got a TV show featuring music geared towards teenagers on a medium that teenagers don't watch.
Yeah.
Like, of course, it's not going to. But what it really reminded me of is just kind of what's happened to rock, where like just 20 years ago, this was great. And this record came out, was like, the record was a big hit. It's a gold record. They sold over 500,000 copies of this record. And it's really catchy. And the music's so much fun and really drives this movie. And of course, is Letters to Cleo.
It has a. So again, watching this back to back with Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains. This is very catchy, very sort of girl pop rocky, sort of in the same way of something like No Doubt, whereas the music in The Fabulous Stains is hardcore punk. So, but both of these movies are trying to accomplish kind of the same goal in their message. So it is like having, it's like going to a whiskey tasting, which I did recently, and you get two whiskeys that are both whiskey but have remarkably different finishes on
one's
them.
Got rye, one doesn't.
Yeah, one's a bourbon, one's a scotch. Like, it's just it's got a very remarkable different finish to it, but they're both selling the same thing, or they're both hitting upon the same ideas. And I really thought it made for a fantastic double feature.
It really does.
I agree with you. The music is great in this movie.
And they both take place over the course of a week. Mm-hmm. Like, they're both like this random. In fact, that's what's funny is in this movie, they really like, does anyone think it's weird that this happened over the course of a week? And they're like, nah.
I love that throughout this movie, it's like a dastardly butler in the background ready to pull a pistol. Alan Cumming has got this cell phone, and every time there's a moment where he thinks that they're onto the scheme, he like takes his phone out, and then they'll say something that leads you to believe they're not onto it, and he just closes it again. It's like his little, because that's the reason that he killed off Du Jour, is they got wise to what was going on.
And at any moment, he's ready to kill another band. Mm-hmm. In fact, they even at one point have the MTV recorded news bit of their death.
Yeah,
like they're so ready to go. They've actually planned how you're going to die and have already had. It's not Tabitha Soren. It's whoever replaced Tabitha Soren
Yeah, she's got a very, very kind of Dutch sounding name, and now I'm having trouble.
Yeah, she goes and is like, yeah. And that's another thing, is this has a number of cameos by people on the scene at the time.
It has so many cameos from people on the scene. It is talking about so much of the music of the time, so much of the fashion at the time, that I'm pretty sure you could only get this DVD by driving to your local elementary school as they dig it up from under the tree in the backyard, because it's a fucking time capsule.
This
entire movie is one giant time capsule.
But they have fun with it. Like, that's the thing, is like Carson Daly, like in most of these things, it's like you'd have like Carson Daly. It's like, oh, hi, Carson Daly. We're on TRL. And he'd be there and be like, hi. And it's like, hey, look, I'm cool. Instead, Carson Daly has a whole sequence in which he's a hired thug who's going to murder the Pussycats.
I have never liked Carson Daly until I saw this movie.
It's kind of great how much fun he's having. Like, they have a fake TRL bit
to lure Melody and Valerie to kill them off, and
because they're just going to become Josie,
because it's just going to become Josie. And what's great is it reminds me a lot of Neil Patrick Harris's cameo in the Harold and Kumar movies.
Yes,
where it's like you have somebody who's known for being like super nice and like and just completely turn that around and play a different.
Well, yeah, well, with him there was like he's, you know, this super down to earth gay man, and in the, you know, in those movies he's just this angry, drug-fueled poonhound.
He is basically a coked-up Barney from How I Met Your Mother.
Yes, yeah.
And they started doing those cameos prior to that show being on the air.
Yeah, and this is exactly that. It's Carson Daly, this guy who is, you know, known for being this nice guy on the scene, who's now he's a murderer.
Yeah, who's hired by Mega Records to
beat in Tara Reid's head with a bat.
Well, as we all have wanted to do at some point. I mean, we all had to sit through those American Pie sequels. I get it. But so they show up at this fake TRL, which is so hilariously manufactured. It's like cardboard people and a poorly painted backdrop. It's clearly not TRL. And then Carson Daly, hey, remember TRL, shows up with Ari Spears. Hey, remember Mad TV? And the two of them are going to kill
Valerie.
Who's,
by the way, making
Melody.
Fun of himself, because the entire time he's doing
impressions,
but he's only doing impressions of black characters.
Yes.
Like, this movie's really subtle. As much as it's in your face, there are times where it's kind of subtle about the satire that it's making.
Now, the accidental satire of this scene is when Ari Spears is trying to do Chris Rock, and she's like, that's a terrible Chris Rock. And he goes, you know who's funny is Bill Cosby. And the joke, it seems like the joke is supposed to be, Isn't it hilarious to think that Bill Cosby would be a murderer? Can you wrap your head around the idea that he would do something so heinous?
So monstrous.
So monstrous. And it's like, yeah, I can...
Bill Cosby and violence against women is something that doesn't really play as comedy anymore.
That's something I want to put back in the time capsule and just bury it further underground. But it is just one of those moments where it's like...
Ooh, that didn't age well.
Yikes. It did not age well. Much like if you leave Jell-O pudding out in the sun for a few years, it also does not age well. But so that plan fails, and so the thing that they're doing in addition to trying to kill off the other members is that they've given Josie this new version or this new mix of their single, and it's really brainwashing her into being a total diva. And she says things like, if we're all putting in the same amount of effort, why isn't it called Valerie and the Pussycats? Like, it's just like, and trying to divide them and conquer. And we haven't even mentioned, by the way, who's playing the head of Mega Records, Megacorp. Parker Posey in this movie, so fucking funny.
Yes.
Just so fucking funny.
Yeah, she's really... This was one of the first movies where I really liked Parker Posey. Parker Posey was like the indie it girl in the late 90s, and she was one of those people who always played these grating characters. She, like, one of her big movies in the 90s was this movie called Party Girl. And as a result of that, like, she kind of blew up on the indie scene, and you saw her everywhere. And for people who went to indie movies all the time, there was this, you know, I'm too cool for Parker Posey kind of thing that, that some of us fell into. And because, you know, when you're young, sometimes you're a douche and you have to get over your shit. and this is the first movie where I was like, oh my God, I fucking love her in this.
When do you plan on doing that, by the way?
Eventually, when I hit my 50s, okay, I think cool. I should probably cool. lean off that.
I'm going to go ahead and put it in the time capsule so that when we dig it up, we'll know exactly what's going on.
Old Man Cargill.
And going back to that time capsule thing for just a moment, this is a very dated... Like, this movie is so dated, I'm not even sure it's Y2K compliant. Because there is literally a scene where... Because one of the running jokes of the movie is that there are product placements everywhere. Have you had your plate today? Intentionally, but they are fucking everywhere.
And this was actually my criticism of the movie when it came out, because I loved the movie when it came out, except for this bit. And I'm glad we're here talking about this. Because in my mind, like, we've actually covered this, again, going back to season one. There is another thing that ties in with last week, because we did an episode on George Clooney where we talked about Grizzly 2, where we also talked about a little movie called Return of the Killer Tomatoes, which has, in my estimation, the greatest parody of
product placement
of all time. Now, several of you go, no, Wayne's World fucking ripped off the bit from Return of the Killer Tomatoes.
Take that, Penelope Spears. Shots fired.
And I still think Return of the Killer Tomatoes is funnier. So I loved what they did in that movie, because they really, like, the whole bit is George Clooney has to stop the movie because they've run out of money for Return of the Killer Tomatoes. George Clooney then offers, hey, what we need is we need product placement. This generic beer shit we've been doing the first half of the movie isn't going to cut it. So let's do product placement. So George Clooney then has a scene that has no purpose but to put as much product placement as possible into the scene. And it's really fucking funny. And there's a version of that Penelope Spheeris did in Wayne's World, where they start talking to them about it, and then they're selling this. Here, my problem with this movie when it came out was this product placement is everywhere, but it's real product placement. And I felt that it would have been funnier had it been fake product placement instead of genuine product placement everywhere. But of course, the joke is it's so everywhere. Like, it's literally written on the wall of the shower.
There are stuffed McDonald's characters inside of her shower.
Yeah, she's actually got a McDonald's French fry loofah that Tara Reid is cleaning herself with while she's doing that. And she keeps dropping it so that she can bend over and show the advertisement behind her on the wall. It's everywhere. Like, they go and throw a girl in a van, and the van drives off, and spray painted on the wall behind the van was MTV.com. like, it is... It is, which, by the way, is the owner of Film.com, which I mentioned earlier in the episode. They bought Film.com, and if you ever go to try to look up any of my old articles that I wrote on Film.com, it just automatically takes you to MTV.com.
Does that mean you're an MTV star? No.
I had left right before they got purchased, but I just found that funny.
There's literally a scene where they pan up to three skyscrapers, and at the top of each skyscraper is like a placement ad to say that this is their building. And I shit you not, it's AOL.com, Sega Dreamcast, and I'm pretty sure the third one is like Ask Jeeves. And it's just like, oh, in one shot, you fuck this
up. But like they literally put it everywhere. There's a scene where they're flying over the city, and there's all the buildings of the city on the edge of the water, and there's this giant fucking McDonald's thing that's literally like the way it's designed, like 15 stories tall. Like it doesn't physically exist. This thing isn't a thing.
It's the ninth wonder of the world.
It's a giant McDonald's landmark. Like this movie, it's just fucking everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's funny. It's a joke fun. That really does play now, especially since several of those bands have the brands have failed.
Yeah. It allows much it to like be AOL, Sega Dreamcast, and Ask Jeeves.
Yeah, but the whole movie is about product placement and pushing that, and they use Josie and the Pussycats to push that so much so that there's not really much for Josie and the Pussycats to do in this movie, which is also kind of awesome.
Yeah.
Like they are ultimately solving the mystery that is like the show and the comic, but we have to get the mystery out first and explain it to the audience before Josie and the Pussycat unmasks them. And there is kind of an unmasking scene as we find out that both of our villains actually are very nerdy and are not actually in their full aren't really themselves, which is also kind of funny, and that ultimately their problems are teenage problems still, because again we're going back to the comic and staying true to the comic in the most bizarre ways possible.
It's weird how they do adhere very closely to the cartoon as well, because if you've ever watched a Josie and the Pussycats cartoon, or if you ever watched Scooby-Doo, it's the same fucking thing. The mysteries are usually solved by we're running from the bad guy, some rock music is playing, we're doing a little montage, and then the bad guy will trip over something and basically defeat himself, and we just pull the mask off. That's entirely what this plot is. They wait for the villains to defeat themselves, and then they pull the masks off.
Yeah, they swing a baseball bat and smash the machine that puts all the subliminal messages in. Because they move right out of the way. Like, it's straight out of the fucking cartoons.
You might as well have been playing the song Pretty Mary Sunlight from Scooby-Doo as this fight scene is happening, because it's going to end the same way as a fucking Scooby-Doo bit or a Josie and the Pussycats bit. Like, really, the only thing missing is that the cat doesn't have the Muttley laugh whenever it's on screen. Like, there's no shot where they cut to the cat and it's doing the Muttley laugh of like... But other than that, it's the fucking cartoon. Right down to the fact that you got Alan in it. You have both Alexander and Alexandra. Alexandra is played by Missy Pyle. I don't know if we actually mentioned that.
We didn't.
She's great in this movie.
Yeah, she's really funny.
And she's just like in the cartoon, and maybe I'm less familiar with the comic, but she's in love with Alan, who's in love with Josie, and she is always trying to be the wedge between Alan and Josie. So she says a lot of snarky. But in this movie, it's not just snarky things. Like, she straight up says things like "you suck" and like "you're always going to be playing in the gutter" and like all these just like really like hateful things. But there's one joke in that realm that makes me laugh so hard. Speaking of dated. The voice of the subliminal message.
Oh, is movie phone.
Is movie phone. And at one point, Missy Pyle hears it, like they discover it, and they're listening, and she goes, "How did you get the movie phone guy to be on your CD? Oh, you slept with him." And just like the idea that you would have to sleep with Mr. Movie Phone to get ahead is like probably the most dated thing about this entire movie.
Yeah.
Just the concept is like, oh my God, if you really want to get ahead in this industry, you better shack up with Mr. Movie Phone.
And then DuJour comes back, as we mentioned earlier. DuJour comes back, and by it comes back, I mean they bring back the one guy, and then the other three guys they've all gotten their ass kicked, and they're all wrapped up in bandages, so it's clearly not any of them.
They're in full body casts, including one of them who had a pet monkey, whose pet monkey is on his shoulder, wrapped in the cast. The thing that made me laugh the hardest in this whole movie is he's like, "We survived. We managed to land the plane, but we landed in the parking lot of a Metallica concert, and those guys kicked our ass." And they're like, well, you look okay.
I thank God every day that I remember the words to Enter Sandman.
And then he's like, we're going to kick your ass du jour style, and throws his cane to one of them that hits the cast, and the guy just falls over. It's such like a Peter Sellers moment. Like, I love it so much. It made me laugh so hard. Because as you know, du jour means apply directly to the side of the rash.
Right.
So, but yeah, and this all culminates into, I keep wanting to say Piper Parabo, but that's not right. Parker Posey decides that, you know, she's revealed as being somebody who, you know, in school had a lisp, and part of her big secret subliminal message is not even so much to buy the products, but everybody needs to love me.
That she's cool.
I'm cool. You know, isn't Fiona so cool, and doesn't she have great clothes? And that's when Alan Cumming reveals that he used to go to the same high school as her, and he was
he was the albino
white ass Wally is what they called him. And he takes his wig off, he wipes the makeup off.
His accent is fake.
That is the best part, is that actually British Alan Cumming has to pretend that his accent is fake throughout the whole movie and adopt an American accent, which for him is fake. That's so many backflips to a joke that I actually really appreciate. And then, of course, all of this leads to the big happy ending of everybody just be yourself. We're going to play this show. Letters from Cleo is going to play. There's a great bit of, because it's the early 2000s and it's a comedy, here's the outtake reel, which is actually pretty funny.
It is. It is. And it's because they had a really great cast. I mean, like, it's funny. I was watching for Rosario Dawson. There's none of it in this one. But Rosario Dawson is well known for fucking around with other with other actors and like playing a game of like obscene chicken. And I'm trying to remember which movie. I cannot remember the name of the movie, but it's one of those forgettable films where Rosario Dawson is paired up as an FBI agent or a federal marshal with, God, why am I blanking on his Sling Blade?
Billy Bob Thornton.
Yeah. Billy Bob Thornton. And on the DVD of extras was just all the times her and Billy Bob Thornton played obscene chicken with one another, saying the raunchiest thing until the other busted up. And it's one of the funniest extras I've ever seen on a DVD, because holy shit, is Rosario Dawson filthy and funny as hell. And so I'm like, wait, is there any of that? And I was like, no, this is before, like, yeah, and they wouldn't have allowed it on this movie, but God, I kind of want some filthy Rosario Dawson outtakes where she just cracks everybody up by saying something truly foul.
I'd be okay with it.
But yeah, it's everybody goofing around and having fun. And of course, the version of that song at the end of the movie when they have the, you know, they have the big kiss. It's such a great emotional fun payoff to that movie. It just works really well, and that concert's great. And the movie, it's just so fucking satisfying.
It really, that's the best word for it. And that is why it's premier junk food cinemas, because like junk food, that's exactly what it is. It's very satisfying. And I also love the bit where they talk about the fact that not only does the megacorp have the ability to get rid of any musician who stumbles across the plot by, oh, look at all these tragedies that happen in rock and roll, which I thought was a really nice touch.
Yeah.
But they also apparently own Behind the Music. So
oh, yes.
As soon as they kill off a celebrity,
and they use it to explain why people disappear.
And there's a great gag that I think goes unnoticed in the movie where they're reporting on the plane crash. They're reporting on the plane crash of du jour, and they're like, and they'll be releasing a commemorative box set tomorrow.
Yeah.
And nobody's wait, what?
No, the line is there's been no official statement from the record company. However, they will be releasing a commemorative box set, which goes on sale tomorrow.
It's like they had it locked and loaded.
Like they were just ready for them to die. And then, of course, they've got the picture du jour up there, and it's like the 2000 to 2001. Like that's the this movie has so many great small gags just littered about. Like, it's one of those movies that you have to watch more than once to catch the weird little shit going on in the background, and it's well worth it. It's a really entertaining film. I love this movie. I'm so glad that I'm 2 for 2 this month, and I can't wait to go into the rest of Gals Who Rock with you and see where we go with that.
You messed with the wrong pussycat.
And that brings us to the junk food pairing. And I mean, talk about an embarrassment of riches this week.
Yeah, this movie's loaded with so much product placement. It's kind of hard to choose which direction to go. I think you and I have gone completely different directions.
Well, yeah, what I'm going to tell you to do as you watch this movie is go ahead and after you finished it, put on your Pumas, put down your Sega Dreamcast controller, log off AOL.com, and go get yourself some Twinkies, a Starbucks Frappuccino, a Diet Coke, and a big bag of Bugles. Because, oh my God, all of those things are touched upon at some point in this movie.
Yeah, I'm gonna go. There is so much McDonald's advertising over this movie. I feel like the proper way to pair up here is with a double quarter pounder with cheese, a side of 6 or 10 McNuggets, depending on if you want Cargill size or Brian size.
Thank you.
A large fry and a large chocolate shake, unless unless it's March. Go with a large shamrock shake,
motherfucker. Why that is not on the menu year round?
It's February, so I figured I have to, like, some of you might be doing this in March, so I figured if you can get a shamrock shake, you know, get it while it's hot
or cold.
That's what I would
don't get a shamrock shake while it's hot. Do not do that.
You tried it?
I will. No, what are you talking? Okay, now you're speaking heresy. What are you talking about? A hot shamrock shake?
Burn,
you know,
the heretic.
You know what? You know what you've got there is you've got a hot pile of goo. That's not even a shake anymore. That's not even a beverage. It's a hot pile of goo. Although I do really want a shamrock shake now. Even as I'm calling it a hot pile of goo, I still kind of want 2 or 3 shamrock shakes. I'm loving it. Yeah.
And before we close out for the night, I feel we need to insert our own subliminal message for at least just one of our listeners. I would just like to say that Junk Food Cinema is the new movie crypt.
It's the movie crypt.
Hi, Joe.
How you doing, Joe? I think Junk Food Cinema is the old 80s all over. That's what I think we are.
Well, there we are. Yeah. 80s all over is the new Junk Food Cinema.
Parker Posey is the old, what's her name? Effie Trinket.
And by the way, if you haven't listened to the Movie Crypt or 80s all over, they're kind of our spiritual sister podcast. So by all means, fucking go out and seek those out because those guys are fucking awesome. All of them.
1,000%. And if you want to check out more of our podcast, you can always do so on iTunes as well as on Blog Talk Radio. You can find us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/ you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. Cargill, where can people find you on AOL.com?
You can find me at AOL.com. No, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Massaworm. That's MassaWyrm. And you can find my book in stores now, Sea of Rust. You can find it wherever you buy books.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury and on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. We're also on Patreon, patreon.com/JunkFoodCinema. If you contribute to that, that's the reason why we don't have to be sponsored by McDonald's. We don't have to be sponsored by Ford. We don't have to be sponsored by Sega Dreamcast.
We don't have to tell you how you can get your free book on audible.com.
This is true. We will not. Well, we may have at the beginning of the show. It's hard to, they pick the ads for us.
I actually don't know. We totally do have ads.
We have ads at the beginning and I don't know what they are because they are picked at random by Blog Talk. So we very well could be sponsored by a Big Mac. So yeah, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema is a great way for you to financially support the show. Keep the lights on and keep getting episodes about things like Josie and the Pussycats, which I'm sorry, you're going to want more of as time goes by. So
and the rest of this month is going to be a lot of fun. Very excited. 2 more movies Brian has not seen yet that are about gals who rock. So thanks for getting this far with us, and we look forward to the rest of the month.
Absolutely. And if you need to find us anywhere else online, just ask Jeeves. Patreon.com/junkfoodcinema.